get started. A couple of announcements for today. There'll be no office hours this Tuesday. UTRF is planning an event that I promised to go present at during normal office hours. As a replacement, I'll open up an office hour right after class on Wednesday. And that maybe will go to about 10:50. I can make it to an 11 o'clock engagement, but from right after class for a little under an hour as a replacement for that. And if that's problematic, shoot me an email and we can schedule something else. I want to remind everybody that homeworks are due at the start of class. I've seen a lot of those getting turned in at the end. That is a sticking point for me, and I'll tell you the reason is that I want to be able to, on Fridays, right after you turn in the homework, answer questions, go over anything that you want to see discussed a little bit more. So if you're turning in at the end, it gives you an unfair advantage because you see me go over things. If you're working on it during class, unfair to the other students. Please make sure to get those in at the beginning of class, not at the end of lecture. Questions on that? So where were we? So we were talking about this 12-volt to 48-volt converter, using it as an example to kind of delve into some discussion of switching loss. So we went through, did some basic analysis of this, got a design, threw it an LT spice, found that our efficiency predicted by this simulation was significantly lower than expected. Expected 97.6. Got 93.9, it's a 2.5 to 3 times increase in our total power losses. To try to figure out why that was happening, we looked at the simulation waveform, found that at one of these switching instances, there's this huge spike in both the diode and transistor current. If we zoom in on them, they look like they're kind of equal and opposite, hundreds of amp spikes in the current through the diode and transistor. So figure out why the efficiency is so bad. This is a significant candidate. In order to understand this, we went through and we started talking about behavior of power diodes. Recalling a little bit of semiconductor physics, we talked about the PN junction diode when used as a power diode having this additional large, lightly doped region and minus region. Fused, we have to build this up to be long and lightly doped in order to block the electric field necessary to give us a higher breakdown voltage. So if I want a 1200 volt device, this region is going to be longer and more lightly doped than a 20 volt diode, where it might be able to be short and fairly heavily doped. And that doping concentration dictates what the base resistance of the semiconductor material is. Longer and more lightly doped means it's going to have a higher resistance. Shorter and more heavily doped, it's going to be more conductive. It's going to have a lower resistance. Okay. So when the diode's off, putting a reverse bias voltage across it develops this depletion region. The depletion region extends into both the N minus and P region. And it extends a distance which is proportional to 1 over the carrier concentration. So my depletion region goes really far into this N minus region, which is lightly doped, and only a little bit into this highly doped P region. This is why I needed that region, to extend the electric field out far into this material to avoid hitting a critical electric field where this thing begins to break down. Okay. Because of this depletion region, when my diode is off, it looks like a capacitor. It's got this big insulating area here with no conductors. Charge is lined up on either end of it. It looks like a parallel plate capacitor. Its capacitance is going to be nonlinear, the function of voltage. So if I apply a larger reverse voltage, this depletion region expands, and it looks like the plates on my capacitor are moving. So it'll be kind of a high capacitance, a low voltage, and as the voltage goes up, plates get further away, my capacitance drops. Okay. Then when I go to forward bias this thing, I get some interesting behaviors. Okay. So important terms from this slide. Minority carrier device, diodes, BJTs, and IGBTs, meaning that the current is supported by minority carriers. It's going to be holes in the N-type region that are injected in my P-type region. My forward bias, this conductors are injected in and they support the current. That allows me to have an effect known as conductivity modulation, which is that I can get the resistance of this thing much lower than what's predicted by just the resistance of the semiconductor material. So I had to have this long, lightly doped region that would have a very high resistance. But fortunately, because of conductivity modulation, I inject a bunch of extra minority carriers in there, and that brings the resistance down and give me a very small diode resistance. That's a great thing. So I have this problematic region, but it's not actually a problem when I put current in, because it's not the electrons here that have to carry the current. It's all these holes that get injected. And the more and more currents I get, the more and more carriers I get. So I'm going to have very small conduction losses because of that. And I still have this barrier voltage, my diode's DF. That's going to result in its own conduction losses independent of the resistance. Okay. So conductivity modulation, great thing. It's characteristic of minority carrier devices. But it's not all sunshine and rainbows. I have this stored minority charge in the device that is what was used to bring the resistance down. But in order to shut this thing off, I have to get all that charge out of there. And we're going to look at what results from that today. So when I'm looking at this stored charge inside the diode while it's forward biased, I have a total charge Q, which is my stored minority charge. That charge follows some equation where the total charge is some function of some Q naught, then lambda. Lambda is 1/ thermal voltage, which is what Q over KT. Okay. And this charge control equation describes how that minority carrier charge changes with operating point. What it's saying is that my change in charge depends on two things, the current in the device, and then the total charge divided by this tau sub L, which is the minority carrier lifetime. Tau sub L is some time constant that describes once the minority charge gets injected, how long does it kind of survive before it hops back across the barrier, recombines, otherwise is lost and is no longer a free carrier. Okay. So it's important I can take this equation and say, okay, if I'm in equilibrium, if I have some constant current, my change in charge is zero, this thing's just in equilibrium, and I get back my diode equation. No surprises there. What I really want to look at is, okay, this concept of a minority carrier lifetime means that, for example, if I took this diode and I put some current through it, all this ID of T, some DC value, and then somehow suddenly just shut it off, send the current to zero. A step function here. When there's current flowing through it, equilibrium, I build up some charge, Q of T, and by relating this equation to this equation, which are almost the same form, you can see that that charge is proportional to the current in the device. Some proportionality constant, more current, more charge. Okay. And then I suddenly shut off the current. That charge is still there. Charges are physical particles. They're going to slowly recombine with a time constant tau sub L. What's going to happen is after I remove all current, I'm going to have this exponential decay, this time constant tau sub L, which T can be on the order of milliseconds. Okay. So if I shut the current off and do nothing, so as I shut this off, the diode is completely open, has nothing connected to it. Eventually, these minority charges will go back into another steady state and the diode will become reverse biased, or right at the boundary, really neither. But I will gradually deplete this region of all minority stored charge. The problem is that this time constant being on the order of milliseconds, that's much longer than I want it to be in a switching converter. I can't just shut off and wait for milliseconds for this thing to actually remove all of its stored charge. If I suddenly switch it, have switching actions on the order of tens, hundreds of nanoseconds, I'm going to be trying to shut this thing off before all that minority charge has a chance to recombine. And the important thing is this thing's not shut off until all of that charge is removed. As long as some significant amount of minority stored charge exists, this thing is conductive and it stays on forward biased. Okay, with that in mind, I want to look at some more realistic diode switching waveforms at both its turn on and turn off instant. I'll do those in the reference frame of my boost converter. I'm going to look first at the diode turn on. My boost converter, I'm going to be examining a circuit that looks like this. Diode turn on is going to happen when I shut off my MOSFET. I'm just going to draw as an ideal switch that opens. That happens at this time here. So before the MOSFET opens, the diode is blocking voltage. Here I'm seeing I sub D and VD. This here will be ID and VD. So it begins at some negative voltage, minus V and zero current. Then this MOSFET shuts off at time zero. Okay. So what's going to happen? Initially, it's blocking voltage, it's reverse biased. I have this big depletion region, devoid of charge. It looks like a capacitance. So initially, this diode is going to look like some capacitance, CD, and be off. If I turn off the MOSFET and it just instantly shuts off, what's going to happen is the current is going to get taken over by the diode. I'll jump up to IL. But until I raise the voltage up above zero, this thing remains reverse biased. And that current's going to flow through this depletion region capacitance, gradually discharging it down to zero. I'm going to see the voltage on the diode ramp up, slope IL over CD until it gets just a little bit above zero, approaches the forward voltage. At this point, I have removed all that reverse bias voltage, and now my diode can actually begin to turn on. So there's this time delay between the MOSFET shutting off and the diode actually turning on. once it does begin to become forward bias, the waveform is going to look a little bit like this, where it eventually steadies out to its on-state voltage. It should be some IL times RD plus forward voltage. Before it gets there, we see this hump in forward voltage, and this is some time delay of this conductivity modulation. When it begins to turn on, it has no minority stored charge and it's highly resistive. And then relatively quickly, as the current ramps up, these minority charges are injected and its resistance comes down. This is due to conductivity modulation. And it's known as forward recovery. Typically negligible. So this is a real phenomenon. It generally happens quickly enough, and that voltage is small enough that it doesn't have really an appreciable effect on your losses. But it is real, and it will happen. It's measurable. During this whole time, taking my inductor current, this point, that inductor current switches over from going through capacitance to going through the actual diode itself. Both are physically part of the diode. Questions on that? Okay. Now, a little bit more complicated, I want to look at the turn-off transition of the diode. I'm going to sketch a full period of the waveforms here, so I'm just going to redraw what we just had. Diode turns on, conducts for a while. The current, IL, see, and then at some point, to shut off the diode, what I'm going to do is turn on the MOSFET again. Okay. I have no control over the diode. The only way I get into the next subinterval is to turn the MOSFET back on. Okay. So what's going to happen? This time, MOSFET turns on. My ideal switch here, close this switch. So my ideal case, MOSFET turns on, diode turns off. I've got perfect square waves, everything's nice. But now what I've been motivating here is we have this large minority stored charge that cannot be removed instantaneously. And as long as it's there, this diode remains on. So when I close this switch, my diode's still gonna be on. It's still conducting. And I'm gonna effectively develop a short and have current develop in this path, call it I spike, some big spike of current that's flowing backwards through the diode while it remains conductive, and down through the MOSFET supplied by this capacitance. Okay. So in order to get all of this minority charge out, I have two options. I either find a way to shut off the current going to the diode without turning on this MOSFET, and then wait some milliseconds while all this minority charge, just based on thermal agitation, goes back where it needs to be. Or I forcibly remove it by applying a field and pulling with negative current through the diode, pulling all this charge back these minority charges back into the P region where they're majority charges. Okay. So what happens here? Essentially, as I turn on this MOSFET, it'll take over all of the inductor current. Current in my diode will drop to zero. But then it's going to continue beyond that. My MOSFET takes over all the inductor current, but because of the shorting path, I'm going to develop additional current through this path. And my diode is going to experience a large spike of negative current that's going to continue until the total area underneath this curve is the minority charge Q. So this we typically call QA, the total area under this portion of the curve. During this time, the diode is still on. It's still locking the voltage somewhere near zero. And it's not until the area under this curve gets large enough to deplete that large N minus region of minority charge that the diode actually begins to shut off. And here, my diode becomes reverse bias. Now that I've removed all that charge. Okay, not quite over yet. As soon as the diode becomes reverse biased, it looks like a capacitance. And now I'm going to need some additional segment of charge here. I'm going to call QB that goes into the diode capacitance at the same time the voltage is changing. This looks like some charge charging a capacitance, bringing the voltage up to its final minus V value. At this point, my switching transition is finally over. Okay. So this phenomenon is known as reverse recovery. It's what happens when I have a switching converter where I'm trying to shut off this diode very quickly, using an active switch to turn off the diode by turning on another switch. And I've got a clamped voltage across the two. So for that short instant where both of these are on, I effectively have a short, develop a very large current. This current is going to be bounded by the impedance of that loop, has to do with resistances of devices and any parasitic inductance in here. But it can be tens, hundreds of amps. Okay. So this whole thing is known as reverse recovery. And it can be one of the largest switching type losses in a converter that uses a PN diode. Okay. Couple definitions. The total reverse recovery charge, QRR, or QR, or sometimes called QRR, is going to be QA plus QB. The total charge supplied to the diode during this time consists of that stored minority charge plus the depletion region capacitance charge. And we also define TR and TRR. This is just the total time. Should be here. This. Okay. In the manufacture of a diode, these things can be affected somewhat. Generally, this reverse recovery charge has to do with exactly how you design the junction. The QA portion of it, that minority carrier charge, is kind of an optimization trade-off. You want a lot of stored minority charge to make sure that you get good conductivity modulation and the conduction losses are low when it's on. But it gives you this problem of it's going to make this power loss, this spike of current, even worse. This QB has to do with the depletion region capacitance. That one, it's somewhat more possible to make small. And back when we were first making power diodes, that was done. The manufacturer said, well, this is a bad thing. Let's make it as small as we can. What that did then made waveforms that look like this in the ideal case. What's known as a snappy diode, where I have almost no QB or QA much greater than QB. My original purple waveform looked more like a soft recovery. Diode where QA on the order of QB. The problem with this green waveform, snappy recovery diode, is that once the diode finally shuts off, I have a very large DIDT because I have very little charge left, and I've ramped down to some very large negative current, and then I just kind of snap it up to zero. If there's any inductance in the loop, I have this huge DIDT, results in an overvoltage spike and blows up your diode. They actually have since gone to soft recovery diodes, which extend this time a little bit intentionally to make sure that you don't blow the thing up when it shuts off. Okay. Questions on this? So this is the effect. Here I've got these waveforms redrawn, and this should be negative VD based on how I defined it before. The waveforms look a little bit like this. I've also kind of drawn out some limited slew rate for how the current is taken over by the MOSFET from the diode. And what I want to do here is figure out what sort of impact on efficiency, what sort of power loss do I expect out of this. In order to solve that in a reasonable way, I'm going to make some approximations to the waveform simplifications. And they'll be the ones I'll expect you to use on homework. So they are, again, kind of design-oriented analysis-based equations. They're not going to be super accurate or justified, but they're going to gain some insight into how this operates. They're going to simplify it so that we can actually use this in calculations. In reality, this DIDT is dependent on parasitic inductance and things that we may not know. It has to do with how you actually lay this thing out, how much inductance there is in this loop. Things like QA and QB can depend on temperature and current and what this ramp rate is, and it can be kind of cumbersome to work with. So what we're going to do is make some approximations. I want to look at first the diode waveforms, ID and minus VD. Let me give some colors to these. So I've already sketched these once and repeated them here, but I'm going to sketch now an approximation to them that makes the math a little bit more easy to work with. I'm going to do in my approximation is I'm going to basically just neglect this time. Any of this ramp down, I'm going to assume that that happens instantaneously. And then I'm going to assume it looks like a snappy diode. Even though I just told you why those things are bad, I'm going to neglect QB. It's the same as saying I'm assuming it's snappy. Even though I know it's not. What that's going to do is it's going to give me really all of my losses in this interval. And what we'll see is that that's actually a pessimistic approximation. So it's going to solve for losses larger than what I'd actually get, which is useful. I'd rather design for it to have 10 watts and only get 8 than design for it to have 10 watts and get 20 and blow it up. Okay. So if I neglect those things, the switching action is going to look like, so current in my diode is going to stay at the inductor current until this time I turn on the MOSFET. MOSFET will take over the current. Diode current is going to drop to zero and then go beyond it. I have some area down here that I'm going to approximate as not just QA, but the total charge, QR. I'm going to neglect kind of this interval, but just lump that charge over into here. Okay. And the voltage on the diode, it looks similar. It's going to be somewhere zero. So after all this charge is removed, and then it's going to ramp up to, in this case, V. Sketching the negative of the diode voltage. Approximate waveforms. Okay, so there are my diode waveforms. What I want to know is diode has this bad behavior. So I want to know what is the power loss on the diode. And what is it in these waveforms? Zero. During all this time, the voltage is approximately zero. During all this time, the current, well, here, the current zero. I always have either voltage zero or current zero. Zero power loss on this thing. Of this whole nasty behavior, but it doesn't result in any loss. I got in more fine-grained detail. This voltage wouldn't be zero, it'd be VF. But I account for that with my conduction losses the normal way. I don't need to worry about that here. Only worrying about modeling really this effect. Okay. So there's no loss associated with this. People believe that? Good. No. Where's the loss? So if I wanted to dig into it, there is actually both current and voltage here, but that's going into a capacitance, and the capacitance is not necessarily a lossy element. We're going to get into that a little bit more in the next lecture, but this energy is not immediately lost. It's just, it's what's needed to get the diode up to its reverse blocking voltage, and it's still sitting there in that capacitance as of this time. So even with that, there wouldn't be any. Looks really nasty, looks really bad. Something must be wrong with it, right? So where is it? Left some axes down here. Why don't we look at the transistor voltage and current? So my ID was this, and my minus VD, this is VD. I'm going to look at my voltage on the transistor, my current in the transistor. What I know is that this current's IL, this voltage is V. So always my MOSFET and diode current have to add to IL. It's on KCL right here. And then the sum of my diode voltage and MOSFET voltage have to add to V based on KVL around this loop. Right. Always IL is ID plus IT, and V is VT plus minus VD. So my MOSFET's current and voltage are going to be just the opposite of the diode's current and voltage flipped around the DC values IL and V. Okay. So if I want to sketch, I have to change colors, the MOSFET current IT, what it's going to look like is ID, IL minus ID. So here that's going to be zero. And then it's going to hop up to IL and then go up above that with some, again, QR. Then after this interval, the MOSFET's going to continue conducting that IL. And its voltage, VT, on the MOSFET, before this begins, the voltage is V. And then during this interval, where the diode has locked that voltage, it's going to continue to be V. The diode has locked the voltage in till the end, when the diode finally shuts off and the MOSFET can short that switch node down to ground. So here is our problem. Now, during this interval, I have simultaneous voltage and current on the MOSFET. Okay. So this is an important thing. It's the diode's fault, but the MOSFET is going to bear the burden. All the losses because of reverse recovery are going to show up down in your active switch. Okay. Real circuit, it's not quite so simple. If we look back at our simulation, see, this is that reverse recovery interval. V switch is the voltage on the MOSFET. Doesn't quite stay locked at V the entire time, but it's pretty close. During the entirety of this reverse recovery interval, it's still 40 volts. And so it's going to bear the majority of the losses. The diode would have some 10% of them, 90% down on the MOSFET. Okay. So what do these losses look like? So the power in my transistor, so the way I'm going to express this, the power dissipated by the transistor due to reverse recovery is going to be some energy associated with this reverse recovery. I'm going to integrate V times I to get that energy. And then that energy is going to be lost once every period, every time this happens. So I'm going to get that energy times the switching frequency. If I switch very fast, I'm doing this more times per second. If I switch very slow, I'm doing it fewer times per second. But every time I switch, I'm going to have this type of waveform and a specified amount of energy. Okay. That energy is just going to be the integral for this time, which is TRR, VT times IT. It's going to look like in this entire time, the voltage is V times the integral of the current. Currents, I've got this square block here, and then this hump which maybe analytically is hard to integrate, but I already know the integral of it. It's QR. The square block is going to be IL times TRR, and then the hump is QR or QRR. Label it as QR in the figure. Okay. So my total power loss due to this is going to be that energy times the switching frequency. Okay. This is just some complete waveforms from the book showing a bit more detail and making up for any of my lack of artistic skill. This is showing some plots from a real commercial device for reverse recovery charge and time. You can see is that for each of these, they vary with the ramp rate, the IFPT, how quickly the current drops when you try to shut it off, with temperature between these two curves. Minority carrier concentration is a strong function of temperature. If it gets hotter, I have more minority carriers, I'll have more minority stored charge. And also with the current that goes through the device before it shuts off, higher current, more charge due to conductivity modulation. Same thing for TRR, so both QRR and TRR are strong functions of temperature, ramp rate at turn off, and the total current they conducted before they turn off. Makes it very hard to accurately model. More often than not, when you're designing a converter, you want to solve for reverse recovery charge, and you'll say, okay, I'm going to have this converter where I have 1 amp. You look at these plots and I get points for 15 amps and 30 amps. How to extend that out to 1 amp is not so simple. Okay. So it tends to be difficult to calculate. Hopefully we understand the mechanism though. Okay. The last thing I'm going to move through a little bit quickly because this is on homework number 4. I'm going to jump to here talking about how do I include switching losses in an average circuit model. Okay. Short answer is just do the exact same thing, but consider your switching losses. Okay. So the idea is going to be you can sketch the waveforms, including any of this non-ideal switching behaviors, and then do your normal averaging with those switching behaviors included, and then draw your model. Okay. So as an example, I'm going to look at the buck converter, and I'm going to consider that reverse recovery exists in this diode, but everything else is perfectly ideal. No conduction losses, no diode capacitance, nothing but this reverse recovery charge and time exists as a non-ideality. Okay. So it'll look a little bit different from the boost converter we just did, but same principles apply, and then I want to derive an average circuit for it. So what I'm going to sketch for understanding are the voltages and currents through the MOSFET and diode. You don't explicitly need those to do your average modeling. You need average voltage on inductor, average current in capacitor, potentially average input current, depending on the topology. I think, so if you can see those, sketch those right away. I think it's a little bit easier if I first sketch the switch and diode voltages and currents. So let's see, if I do VT and IT up here, minus VD and ID down here. I'm gonna start with just the ideal and then I'll modify them for reverse recovery. So ideally the first interval, my MOSFET's on, it'll have zero voltage, and it'll shut off, ramp up to some, in this case, VG, my VT, my diode, gonna be blocking VG, go down to zero when it turns on. Red, my transistor current, it's gonna look like IL, zero, IL. My diode current, zero, IL, zero. Okay, just my perfectly ideal waveforms to start. Now I'm going to modify these by including reverse recovery. So reverse recovery, I'm going to look at the switching intervals. So here, what am I doing? I am shutting off the MOSFET. When I shut off the MOSFET, the diode's reverse biased. If I was considering its capacitance, I'd have some kind of slew rate limit on how fast its voltage rises. If I'm neglecting that, this interval is still ideal. Shut off the MOSFET. Diode turns on, no problem, because I'm only considering reverse recovery. This interval, where the diode is on, conducting a current IL, and then I turn the MOSFET on, is going to be the one where this reverse recovery charge has some effect. My reverse recovery is going to happen here. And the way that's going to happen, well, in order to regulate, I need my voltages to remain the same. I need this to still be DTS. If I start changing the width of my voltage pulse, I'm going to change the output voltage. So based on my waveforms here, MOSFET voltage stays high during the sole interval. So I'm going to sketch these as really happening here. Okay. Now, I guess, how did I know that this pulse of current was going to show up in both of these waveforms? If I look at my circuit, what happens? My diode is on, it's conducting current, and then I turn my MOSFET on. As I turn that on, the diode won't shut off until the minority charge is removed. So I'm going to have, for an instant, both of these things on, and I'm going to have this spike of current here. Oh, excuse me. I drew this wrong. Apologize for that. I have the spike of current goes through the MOSFET and then the reverse direction through the diode. That's going to look like the diode is now going to shut off a little earlier. Get rid of this. And then have this negative spike. Lost my purple. And my MOSFET is going to turn on a little earlier and have this positive spike. This time is TRR. The point I was trying to make previously, I knew this had to come in because if I extended it out here, had my normal switching action, and then my reverse recovery, the MOSFET voltage would extend out because it doesn't shut off until the end of that reverse recovery time. And then I'd be applying a higher duty cycle effectively to the inductor. I'd lose regulation. Okay. So the important part of this is looking at this reverse recovery current spike and figuring out what elements it's going to go through. Okay. And I figured that out by saying, okay, this thing's going to stay on. That's going to be on. I have somewhat of a short. What's the path that shorting current is going to flow? Through the output capacitor in my boost. It was through the input source, my buck. It'll be through something else and different converter topologies. But you can always look at them, consider them both on, and find what elements that flows through. Okay, just out of time. So my average model, I do volt second balance. Okay, voltage didn't change on my transistor and diode. say the voltage on the inductor is the diode voltage minus the output voltage. So the voltage on the inductor doesn't change. This is going to be the same as normal. Current in the capacitor. Well, none of this has anything to do with what's going on at the capacitor. It's still IL minus V over R here. So that gives me my equivalent circuit that looks like on the D, short, non-inverting, IL, R, V. No effect on the average model. I haven't finished drawing it yet. What else do I need in the buck converter? I need to average my input current. I have the switch directly in series with it. So I need to take this extra step of doing the input current averaging. Okay. So my average IG is equal to 1 over TS times the integral of the input current. The input current is the MOSFET current. It's going to look like is this block, which is DTS IL, plus the integral of what's going on during reverse recovery, which is going to be TRR IL plus QR. This will look like DTS IL plus, excuse me, QRR plus TRR IL. I divide that out. This is DIL plus QRR over TS plus TRR IL over TS. D prime IL was the source that linked here that gave me this transformer. Now the rest of this is going to look like my input source, VG, an average current. IG, got my DIL flowing here, and now I have two more currents that are shunt at the input. It'll look like QRR over TS and TRR IL over TS. Hard to read. Those both become just shunt currents here at the input. Okay, sorry for going a little over on time. Wanted to make sure you guys had seen this for the homework. If there's any questions, we can address them at the beginning of class next time.